Well, it's a real pleasure to introduce our first keynote speaker. Dr. Grinker is professor and chair of anthropology at George Washington University. He received his PhD in social anthropology from Harvard University. And in addition to the interesting work he's doing in autism, he studies a lot of other very interesting topics, including North-South Korea relations, which I would love to talk to you about someday. Very interesting work. But he's brought his anthropological perspective to autism in the past several years, and his work there spans a wide range. He's one of the key players in a really important paper that we all know, which I think was one of the very only total population prevalence studies of autism that came out in 2011, I think, right? Kim et al. And that was a really very important paper. A lot of us cite it all the time. And he also does qualitative research, which I've heard him present on, absolutely fascinating, but looking at cultural differences in manifestation of autism, autism diagnosis and treatment practices and things like that across many cultures, Korea, India, South Africa, United States. Fascinating to listen to. In fact, side note, after I heard him speak one time, I went home and made my teenagers listen to his talk on the internet because it was so interesting to hear what he has to say. So I think we're in for a big treat today. He's the author of the book Unstrange Minds, Remapping the World of Autism, which is both a really fascinating account of cultural factors in autism research and also of raising a daughter with ASD, and maybe he'll tell us a little bit about that today. But as I mentioned, I've heard him speak on a couple of previous occasions. He's a wonderful storyteller, wonderful speaker. He provokes discussion on topics that many of us really haven't thought about, at least speaking for myself, I had not thought about. But really, once I heard him speak, think about quite a bit, which is why it's so great to have him here today, extending that perspective for all of us. I don't think many of us have heard an anthropologist speak about autism. And today he's going to tell us about who owns autism, exceptionalism, stigma, and stakeholders. So please join me in welcoming and thanking him for being here. Dr. Grinker.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I really appreciate the invitation. It's a great honor to be here, and I'm delighted to be speaking among so many familiar faces, people that I've been friends with or have worked with over the years. I would like to tell you, first of all, that I'm not going to use PowerPoint. And it was really interesting because I was thinking back to the first time that PowerPoint came out. I don't remember what year it was, and we were all getting used to it, and I was one of the first people in my department that used it. And I told people I was going to go give a talk, and I was using this thing called PowerPoint, and they said, "Wow, you're so brave. You're so courageous to do that. I don't know how you're going to do that. This thing up there, and there's slides that... you're really brave." And so yesterday at the reception, all these people came up to me and said, "Are your slides ready? You got everything all set with your slides?" And I said, "Oh, I'm not using slides." And they said, "Oh, you're so brave. You're so courageous." So the more things change, I guess. I want to, I hope to do exactly what was described in the introduction, which is to be thought-provoking and to provide some different perspectives. I'd like to begin by telling a story, a brief story, which is that not long ago I was in a crowded room and I heard a voice behind me. And the voice said, "All right, Sparky, here's the deal. You want to court the little lady? You got to be a straight shooter." And I turned around and I saw a boy who was 13, maybe 14 years old, continuing on with what is the script from the movie Aladdin. I've seen the movie many times, as many parents have. We've probably seen it too many times. And he had his fingers in his ears. Now, this repetition of words and phrases from movies wasn't particularly new to me. I had seen it in many people with autism. I'd seen it in my own household. Putting one's fingers in one's ears is a common posture known to people who are familiar with autism, and I'd seen that as well with my daughter Isabel, who's now 23 years old. But what was different about this occasion was that this was a Zulu boy waiting for his mother in an antiretroviral clinic in rural KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. The reason that I tell this story is to make the point that autism exists everywhere. But we've not always called it autism, and the meanings of the word itself change over time and according to context. Now, suppose I say to you that autism is a mid-20th century, late 20th century construction that is a historically contingent assemblage of specific and observable behaviors selected from an almost infinite array of behaviors. By saying this, I don't mean that the phenomena of autism do not exist. My daughter would have difficulty with social communication no matter what diagnosis she had. A constructivist approach does not deny that there's an underlying biological condition that can produce suffering. Rather, it acknowledges, first, that our models of conditions are historically contingent, and secondly, that our models often race ahead of what is actually known, make educated guesses, make attempts at grand syntheses. And sometimes our models are used to justify the practices that surround identification and treatment of a condition. In some sense, this is like the old nature culture problem. And you could choose any metaphor that you want of how culture appropriates nature or transforms nature. The metaphor that I like is the metaphor of the block of marble that the anthropologist Marshall Sollins uses, which is to say there's a block of marble in maybe northern Italy, Tuscany, and it is what it is. It's made by nature. There's some stuff you can do with it, of course, but it has its limitations. But it is culture that determines whether this block of marble becomes the David of Michelangelo or whether it becomes a monument to a great leader. Now, you could argue, I suppose, that whatever becomes of that marble is predetermined by its properties. But even then, we can't forget that that piece of marble was selected from among all other possible ones because some sculptor saw within it the latent image of his own project. So I want to discuss context today. Because when we speak about autism, or when in the foundation name Autism Speaks, we often think we are, to paraphrase the philosopher Jacques Derrida, talking about that of which we speak, as opposed to that out of which we speak. Given that I'm an anthropologist, you might expect I'm going to favor discussions about different cultures, and I think that that's a very valuable approach. But I also think that one of the values of anthropology is that it can provide a perspective that helps us to unmask the cultural foundations of science's representations, science's advocacies, philanthropies. There certainly is much culture in this room here as there is in the village of an African rainforest. My talk's in two parts. The first, I want to talk about context. And by context, I mean the larger system of knowledge, ideology, and governance in which autism exists. And again, my goal really is not to come to some kind of resolution, but rather to be thought-provoking and to complicate the idea that autism is unique, or to use another term, exceptional. Many researchers working in the field of autism have treated it as an island to be explained in terms of itself, though the histories and the biology of many conditions across medicine share many themes and patterns. And then in the second part of the talk, which is a little bit shorter, I think, than the first part, I'm going to talk about something that we're all familiar with, as an exemplar of some of the conflicts inherent in the way we conceive of autism today. And that thing is the puzzle piece. The puzzle piece that is a logo, an icon, an image for many organizations, and has endured. And I'm going to focus on that, to discuss that a little bit. Derrida writes that nothing exists out of context. And Foucault says that we live within epistemes. Epistemes are bigger than Thomas Kuhn's notion of scientific paradigms. Epistemes are the total or the totality of discursive practices that give rise to forms of knowledge such as medicine, economics, and history. In the history of psychiatry, for example, the doctor or the expert emerges not as somebody who possesses knowledge, but as someone who possesses a new system of ordering knowledge. In other words, the history of psychiatry didn't proceed because of the accumulation of knowledge. It began as a system of ordering on the coattails of modernity. We know that the rise of institutions in Europe, schools, prisons, hospitals, accompanied the rise of capitalism, and along with capitalism, a new way of thinking and ordering the world. New modes of production don't just change the way we behave. They also change the way that we think. And it changes the way we think about almost every realm of life: kinship, religion, marriage, economy, politics, and so on. So what changed from Pinel, you know, who's credited with really the first humane treatment of the mentally ill, to Freud, was less about new knowledge than about a new system of ordering knowledge, of which psychiatry was just one part. Just a caveat, since I've said the word psychiatry several times, I don't mean to reduce all questions to psychiatry, as if psychology, social work, occupational therapy, and so on don't exist. But because I want to focus in this first part on classification, I really want to look at the owners of classification, the people who sort of spearheaded that, which turns out to be psychiatry. So just a caveat there. With the rise of academic disciplines in medicine, psychiatry became organized and coherent, and therefore intelligible as a distinct body of knowledge, texts, and practices that structured understanding and treatment. And we need only think about the DSM to understand this point. It is a system of ordering. It is a system of classification, presumably based on a system of knowledge, but it is also a form of governance or psychiatric governmentality. Anybody who's filled out a insurance form knows that. It's also a commodity. In fact, I don't see how you can be easily in the fields that I just mentioned before without owning a copy of the latest DSM, because the DSM owns the classification of mental illness. So our academic disciplines emerged kind of like all other institutions. And by institutions, I don't mean buildings. I mean these bodies of knowledge and practice. And they emerge, as the word discipline suggests, to control, to correct, to train, to keep us on track. They're organized hierarchically. They're under surveillance. And they inflict micro-penalties on us when we diverge from them. Like in scholarship, when we don't fit convention exactly. Like when we talk out of turn, when we're late for school or class or a job. The institutions that have been formed over so many years have been conceived in a particular way that for us seems to be commonsensical. In fact, it's very difficult for people to imagine that schools, hospitals, militaries, whatever, jails, could be organized in any way other than to be divided up and ordered into small units with highly formalized, controlled, and orderly operations. And the amazing thing is our abstract principles and our abstract oppositions, like right and wrong, moral, immoral, lay, expert, rational, irrational, they derive from these oppositions, and it is within the confines of those oppositions that we define ourselves or conceive of ourselves. So knowledge becomes a form of governance and power exercised by those who claim to possess it, those whose societies endow with the authority to possess it and sometimes to police it. And science becomes a form of power not through coercion or imposition, but by aligning different agents into a shared vocabulary and a shared object of attention. The power is not out there in the open, obvious to us, because it's enclosed within the ideology that simultaneously legitimates it and masks it. So if we consider a particular psychiatric condition, say as defined by the DSM, we don't see it as a form of governance that guides action as much as we see it as constituting a medical and scientific problem to be solved in terms of medicine and science. So I now want to talk about autism as a kind of a singular category, because the sense we have often is that it's new and exceptional, a thing in and of itself, a product of what philosopher Hannah Arendt once called the appearance of freedom in the universe, that something looks to be new because we have the freedom to conceive of it as new. And what happens as things change is that antecedents fade into the distance. We forget them, or we convince ourselves that we have better knowledge. So autism was childhood schizophrenia, and then it was not. It was considered to be unrelated to seizures and intellectual disability, and then it was. Autism was a mental illness, then it was a developmental disability. Asperger's disorder existed, then it didn't, or maybe it still does. Hard to know. Autism is a construct that is discussed to some extent by, and named, by the way, with the word autistic, by De Sanctis in Italy in 1906, by Heller in Austria in 1905, by Bleuler in Switzerland in 1908, by Sukareva in Kiev in 1926, and by Freud in Austria in 1924. Yet, there is, for all intents and purposes, a belief in a single origin, Leo Kanner, the person who prefaces almost every historical account of autism as if autism was born in 1943. Well, what else do we consider to be new? Think about all the kinds of people that are new. What Ian Hacking aptly calls making up people. And these are kinds of people that exist today that didn't exist before. Let me rephrase that. They exist today, but didn't in a classificatory sense exist before. Post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, multiple personality disorder, MPD, are new conditions. Yet people have always had trauma. And there have always been people who have had severe dissociation. What we have not always had is a group of experts who created those classifications, justify them as valid, integrate them into institutions, and employ them by diagnosing individuals, individuals who come to see themselves in terms of the diagnosis, all of which makes the classification feel legitimate and authentic. Ian Hacking calls this the looping effect. And so it's not surprising that if somebody criticizes a particular construct like PTSD or MPD or Asperger's, that many people interpret it as a personal attack, an attack on themselves, because that concept has come to define them as people. That's the power of these concepts, and that is why also these concepts sometimes lead to great stigma. One could make the argument that autism and other diagnoses have been fetishized. And I want to talk a little bit about that word fetish. I've not heard it in relation to mental illness and psychiatric issues and disabilities and so on. But the concept seems to work for me. Now, I don't mean fetish in the sense of something sinister. I don't mean fetish in the sense of something sexual. I don't mean it in the religious sense, though I suppose we could all come up with some conditions that people defend almost as if they're sacred objects. I mean fetish in the sense of something singular, set apart, whose conditions of being do not depend on its commonalities or similarities with other phenomena. It's set apart in a system of classification as something which is real. Marx, of course, used the concept of fetishism famously to talk about the commodity. He argued that money is fetishized as having a real and objective value. Even a life of its own, like when we talk about a stock market being bullish or bearish and we animate the market as if it has a life of its own, or when we say, oh, the market doesn't like this or the market doesn't like that, as if the economy operates on its own like an animal. We come to believe that it has a real and objective existence with real value, when in fact, the value of a piece of paper in your pocket right now or a coin in your pocket right now isn't contained within that object. It's contained within the society that gives it value. Its value comes from the complex social relations of production, and it does so without us even being aware of it. So just as the value of money seems natural in an economy based on markets and commodities, so too is autism made real by the extraordinary amount of activity that takes place around it. I mean, why would we be thousands of us here if this thing wasn't, something wasn't real? From the basic sciences to epidemiology, treatment, intervention, schools, services, and professional conferences. I mean, it's really amazing. This is a big crowd, and think of all the labor that went into this, and all of the effort, and all of the money, the fuel, the hotels, the organization that was involved, all of the collaborators, all organized around a particular object. And think about all the work and labor of the people that we left at home or at our jobs who were kind of filling in for us and doing the things we can't do because we're all here, or at least all of you are here focused on me. So all of this organized around a framework that we've created called autism. And in the midst of so much activity, which seems to justify the category, it's hard to see that a disease construct or a condition construct may have been so profoundly fetishized that we fail to see its cultural constitution. And there's a danger in not seeing cultural constitution, because if you think that something just is what it is, then we don't change it. We don't understand that we have the capacity to change it. We've got the capacity to shape that block of marble into what we want it to be, and what is most useful, and what is better for people. Biomedical approaches to disease and disabilities often assume that disease constructs are stable, uniform, or grounded in nature rather than culturally constituted. But just think for a moment about a few conditions in the world that are highly infused with meaning, like AIDS, which was conceived of as a plague, cancer conceived of as an evil, leprosy that was conceived of as decay and corruption, and autism, which has in some times and places been conceived of as loss. These examples show us that diseases one might think are based on empirically verifiable phenomena, like the stuff you can see in a microscope, are always constituted by normative values. The experience of disease, in other words, the disease as illness, is not written in the cells of a tumor or in the molecules of a virus. So in fact, many scientific representations do not come from science itself. Robert Barrett has shown very clearly how the conceptualization of schizophrenia as the split mind, schizine, split, freen, mind, emerged not out of any scientific discovery, but out of the arts and the literature of German Romanticism and some philosophizing in France about human and cultural variation. There were two traditions then. In Europe, in Germany and in other parts of Europe, you have a tradition of seeing the mind as binary, as constituted by dark and light, good and evil. And this emerges within the realm of arts and literature first, in Doppelganger, in Faust, in Frankenstein, in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. In The Picture of Dorian Gray, I'm sure you can come up with others as well, that propose the existence of a binary mind. And at the same time in Europe, you have a set of theorists who are trying to explain why people aren't all like Europeans. Europeans were the model of the perfect and coherent mind. And so non-Western peoples and people with severe psychiatric conditions came to represent the fragmentation or the disintegration of the mind. And it's remarkable. 140 years, more than 140 years, since Dostoevsky wrote in The Raw Youth that the second self of a person is a sign of the mind's division and deterioration. 140 years. And if you go to look at a set of advertisements in 2015 for antipsychotic medications, you will find clear, right in your face, depictions of human beings split in two, or a person standing on the ground that is fracturing beneath him into two. And this concept of schizophrenia as the split mind, the word itself, owes its existence largely to European Romanticism and certainly not to any scientific discoveries. In other words, representations have real effects. They can contribute to the stigma people experience because representations can imply a theory of causation. Explanatory models can be deeply rooted in society, as when autism is conceived of, you know, with long-standing traditions of religion, religious beliefs, supernatural causation, or even in moribund models like the psychoanalytic legacy, in which cold, unloving mothers, was thought that cold and unloving mothers caused autism. And so today, often I hear that parents are feeling that they may be blamed when an intervention is directed at them, like a parent training group or trying to help a parent to do something different that might help the child, that this legacy comes back that can make somebody think that they're being blamed for it. In 2004, the Japanese Society of Psychiatry and Neurology felt compelled to do something about the extraordinary stigma that had been created by this notion of the split mind, which does not have a basis in science. The mind is not split into these two in schizophrenia. And so they changed the name. And please forgive me if there are Japanese speakers here, and I will say Japanese words with a terrible pronunciation. Seishin Bunretsu Byo, which is mind split disease, and it was changed to Togoshicho, integration disorder. The previous term was so stigmatized that few clinicians ever wanted to mention the word to families or the individuals who they were treating. Imagine if you were told then how much stigma you had. And after they renamed schizophrenia in 2004, the percentage of cases in which patients with schizophrenia were informed of their diagnosis increased from 36 to 69% in 3 years, doubled in 3 years. The definition of autism and other conditions in terms of a group of deficits or impairments, the so-called deficit model of autism, may be another legacy of the tradition of explaining difference as diversion. The New York University Child Study Center 2007-08 Ransom Notes campaign ad for awareness and treatment is illustrative here. The letters, I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, but the letters were from kidnappers. And one letter to a parent and signed autism read, "We have your son. We will make sure he will not be able to care for himself or interact socially as long as he lives. This is only the beginning." Now, there were such letters for Asperger's disorder and for ADHD and other childhood issues, but I'm just giving you this one example here. And because I want to say something about that view that's kind of inherent in that advertisement. What does that say to you? It says that the autistic person is lost, abducted, kidnapped. And again, that's not the result of scientific research. That's a cultural gloss. That's a particular objectification of the human mind, the idea that the human being with autism has been damaged. The autistic person from that perspective is deficient, dysfunctional. And in many memoirs by parents as well, diagnosis of autism becomes a proxy for the onset of autism, but also the sudden disappearance of the child. In her book, The Accidental Teacher, Annie Lehman calls autism, quote, a greedy disability, unquote, because it takes away so much. So this representation of autism taking away rather than possibly involving difference or adding something or giving us something different or useful in a new social context does not get much play. So I think it's really worth thinking about autism as a fetish because experts and quote-unquote stakeholders have endowed the diagnostic category with the central features of a fetish. It's a thing, sui generis, the power of which is consolidated as it subsumes an increasingly broad array or spectrum of heterogeneous elements, a process of which the DSM is certainly a part. Its reification, this making it real, masks the relations in history of the relations of its production. And by being masked, it has the power to order our ideas and experiences without us being aware of it. So despite the fact that autism may contain within it a wide range of variation, we have accepted it as an objective discursive object. If autism feels new as a totality, it should, because it is new as a totality. And you find a similar thing in other areas of economics. I mean, other areas of social science, like economics. Ask an economist whether the notion of the economy is new. And they will tell you, oh, yeah, it's like 50 years old. 1940, 1950, 1960. Before that time, economists didn't consider that there was something called the economy that they studied. They studied economic topics, household expenditures, whatever it was that that economists do. I don't know. There is something similar with autism as well. Because autism used to exist just in its adjectival form as autistic and is first nominalized in the DSM in 1980 with the publication of the DSM-3, and that's when it becomes a noun, kind of officially a noun, a thing in and of itself. So, if autism is a representation, or let's say just a representation, why is it so powerful? And the answer may be that there's something more fundamental underneath this representation that reinforces its singularity and its reproduction over time. The cultural geographer David Harvey said that for any system of thought to become dominant, it requires that there be concepts that are so embedded in common sense understandings of the way we live that they're taken for granted and beyond question. So perhaps that fundamental something that is so powerful underneath the representation isn't just discursive, but maybe it's something actually material in the world. Maybe it's something objective. Perhaps it is that system of ordering in the kind of free market society in which we live now, in which everything is ordered and in its place within large systems. That includes capitalism, it includes science, it includes medicine. Autism, in some memoirs, possesses a person. It can shape personhood and social identity. It's codified, so it becomes standardized in our vocabulary about human behavior. It's the foundation of an enormous range of institutions. It can be a kind of culture, as for some self-advocates who see autism as a way of life mediated through distinctive skills and challenges. It becomes a site around which celebrities, media, and other circulators of information gather. I was struck when many years ago I was listening to CNN, watching CNN, and Larry King, remember him, came on and gave a teaser about the show that was going to come on later that night. And he said, "Is there an epidemic of autism? Join us later with comedian Bill Cosby and singer Toni Braxton." Once established, autism feeds an industry of therapists. Complementary and alternative medicine, pharmaceuticals, special educators, special education programs, group homes, other facilities that are established and maintained by government or nonprofit organizations. And each of these entities depends for its continued existence on the availability of people classified as autistic. James Gurney's data from the state of Minnesota public schools shows large increases year to year in the administrative prevalence of ASD in single birth cohorts between the ages of 6 to 11. In other words, there were successive new autism classifications at ages 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and so on for a condition that we know, or we at least we've agreed on, has its onset before 36 months. It may be that higher numbers require more services, but it may also be that more services require more classifications, which in turn require more resources, and so on. So this industry requires the availability of people with autism. It also requires the availability of people like us, people like you, autism experts. The industry is necessitated by, requires, and produces new laws, high-cost diagnostic instruments, screening tools, new forms of evidence and analysis, even new forms of aesthetics. And these new phenomena are supported by philanthropists, advocacy organizations, schools, governments, research foundations, researchers in need of funding, professional conferences constituted by researchers in need of funding. In other words, autism may be imagined as a singular phenomenon, but it doesn't exist in isolation. Just think about the money that gets spent on autism with aggregate costs per year, if you include the United States and the UK, potentially in the hundreds of billions of dollars. Where does this money go? How is it used? Why do we devote so much to it? So imagine how hard it is then for people to resist these forces. Even if new and innovative stakeholders want to lead the fight for some aspect of advocacy, they have no way of matching the networks and the finances of this matrix, let alone just one of the large corporate or philanthropic entities. Let's pause for a moment. I'm almost done with the first part of this talk. And think about this word stakeholder, since I used it a few times. It is typically defined, forgive me if there's someone who has a different definition, but it's typically defined as a person or an institution that has an interest in ensuring the success of a particular organization or business. We usually use the term stakeholder to mean anybody who has an interest or involvement with something. And in autism, I have always used the term stakeholder to mean everybody who's involved in some way, though I do notice that in many of the texts produced by the Autism Speaks Foundation over the years, they've separated scientists and stakeholders. And I don't know why that is, but because I think scientists are among the biggest stakeholders. But at any rate, when an organization calls me a stakeholder because I have a child with autism or because I do research on autism, there's an implicit assumption that everyone involved has an interest in helping produce, preserve that object of the organization, of an organization's work. Stakeholders are all, in a sense, owners of autism with a stake in protecting it, whether as an object of study or a professional or a social identity. So, to conclude the first half of my talk, let's return to the title I gave. Of course, you know, when you give talks, you often give a talk that's different than what your title was originally going to be. But I want to get back to that. I mean, you all know that. You submit a title, you submit an abstract, time goes by, and then you're preparing your remarks and you're saying, I've got to do that. So anyway, let's go back to my title, which is Who Owns Autism? I think there's an obvious answer to that, but an unsatisfactory one. The obvious answer is that we all own autism, but it's unsatisfactory to me based on what I've already said. I'm not sure it's a satisfactory answer because it presumes a kind of buy-in to the concept of autism as a real, stable thing rather than something that we've created. And that's what I've been arguing against. Marx's idea of the fetish was that humans create an economy that then appears to be natural and then have an independent existence to which they are then subordinated. And my argument about autism is that we've created a concept that appears to us to be natural and have an independent existence, or at least independent of scientific ideology, and around which we organize a multitude of activities and shape identities. So, to illustrate my argument, it might be better to turn this question on its head and not ask who owns autism, but who does autism own? Thus giving an answer that I think is more faithful to the concept of the fetish, that autism owns us. So let me let you digest that odd turn of phrase for a second. Now, I'm now going to switch gears a little bit to talk about a debate about the reification of autism for what it tells us about stakeholders. It's the puzzle piece. The puzzle piece as a symbol for autism awareness, advocacy, and services is ubiquitous. I think with the exception of the pink ribbon for breast cancer, I know of no other image that is so clearly associated with a particular condition. David Mandel, who's already been discussed today, the editor of INSAR's journal, Autism, recently asked me to think with him about a group of letters that he received about the puzzle piece. As you know, the puzzle piece has been on the cover of the journal since its inception. But there were well over 100 letters, I'm not exactly sure how many, people writing into the journal either in praise of the puzzle piece as a great representation of autism research, treatment, advocacy, and other people who wrote in saying that it was not, and there were even some vitriolic points that were made. And so I think the issue is interesting because the disagreement about whether the puzzle piece, is an appropriate image or what it means, is the debate's not about whether autism is a good concept or not. It's about how to represent it conceptually and materially, about who has the right to represent it. When David approached me, actually my very first thought was about Isabel, my daughter Isabel, because she loves puzzles. So she calls herself autistic, or variously says, I have autism, or I'm autistic. And she uses it sometimes to talk about her strengths by saying that autism makes it easier for her to do complicated jigsaw puzzles. And sometimes she does the puzzles with the picture side down to make it more challenging, so that she's just putting it together by shape. But inexplicably, at the end of every puzzle, there's a one piece missing. And she can't describe to us why she puts a piece under her pillow or in her jewelry box or in her pocket. The next thing I thought about, because when somebody asks you, let's think about the puzzle piece, it's not like you go to the archives of general psychiatry. You know, you're sort of going with your train of thought and seeing what associations you have. And my next thought was about James Merrill's poem, Lost in Translation. It's his most famous poem, arguably, one of the great 20th century American poets. And it's about a missing puzzle piece. The missing puzzle piece in that poem represents Merrill as a child, what he describes, quote, as an inchling, innocently branching palm. But the child also represents the entire puzzle. So for him, as for Isabel, and I would guess for all of us, there always seems to be a piece missing. Life, by definition, is never complete. The image that we construct of ourselves may seem real and coherent at any particular moment, but its shapes and meanings change constantly, perhaps like autism itself. A dynamic puzzle that eludes any solution, a whole that can never be whole. The puzzle piece is now associated largely with the Autism Speaks Foundation and the Autism Society of America. But it was first used for autism advocacy in 1963 in the newly established National Autistic Society, or NAS, in England, an organization founded by parents and modeled on the Spastic Society of Children with Cerebral Palsy. The logo, no longer used by the NAS, was designed by Gerald Gasson, parent of an autistic child and member of the NAS Board of Directors. Gasson superimposed on the image of the puzzle piece a crying child to illustrate both that autism is a baffling condition and that people with autism do not, quote-unquote, fit in. Why does the puzzle piece endure, and why is it at various times generating more or less controversy? One way to begin answering the question, I think, is to consider autism, the phenomenon to which this puzzle refers, as an explanation for the confusion and sometimes intense suffering people experience as they struggle to relate as individuals to societies that are constantly changing shape. Certainly, the communities into which autistic individuals are born today is very different from the past, when so many people were given diagnoses that were unhelpful, when people were institutionalized, and so on, when mothers were blamed, when schools and employers couldn't offer much. I've said many times when I've spoken to my students or in lectures like this that I think it's a better time than ever to be autistic. While there is much more that can be done to support people with disabilities, we do offer unprecedented possibilities. Just as Merrill's puzzle stands for the unstable relationship between the individual and the human condition in general, so too is autism an ever-changing assemblage of ideas and practices that perhaps, like any historical construct, is a set of relations at once interlocking and in tension. The meanings and values of autism as we now conceive it, like genetics or economics or any category that we use to explain human variation, they change constantly because societies change. So maybe much of this tension is really about what that puzzle piece relates to. What's the relationship between the part and the whole? And that may be the relationship between the individual and the society. I think it is. In other words, much of the debate really has to do with the relationship between the part and the whole, and in a sense, it's really a debate about who has the authority to interpret the symbol and its referent. Ironically, the word symbol comes from the ancient Greek. It was the ancient Greek term for a fragment of a token or an entry pass, sort of like when we go to a theater, a concert, and we give a ticket, and they take half, and we keep the other half. So the verb to symbolize, which is symbolen, it meant to put together, to make whole. And it meant, or was referring to, the inferences that we make from incomplete information. Similarly, although each piece of a jigsaw puzzle is unique, the desire to work on a puzzle presupposes that both that the pieces will interlock, and that we know what the puzzle will look like, because we got a cover, and this has pictures there on the cover. We know what it's going to look like, Cinderella's castle, or whatever it might be. But for autism, the whole is always different. For many researchers, that whole to which the part refers is a coherent system of scientific knowledge that explains, treats, and perhaps even cures what we call autism. For some autistic advocates, however, the whole is a definition of normalcy championed by the normal or the neurotypical. In the view of these advocates, the incomplete puzzle represents that deficit model of autism I discussed. It suggests there's something missing in people with autism. And the completed puzzle, or cure, will mean the destruction, not only of their personhood, but of the positive characteristics of autism that contribute to human diversity and creativity. Indeed, some self-advocates may identify more with the piece itself than the puzzle, arguing that they're best represented by a piece that will never and should never fit in. And they may find comfort in Andrew Solomon's position that otherness is really the normal. Still, other advocates see the imagined puzzle to which the piece belongs as society at large in the lone, separated piece as a representation of autistic isolation. And for them, the image challenges their current experience. It challenges their current experience if it's seen as autistic isolation, because so many autistic self-advocates are working so hard to demonstrate that people with autism do build and maintain meaningful social relationships. So much of the popularity of autism as a category comes from the fact that it's just so big. It's so open to interpretation, so amorphous, so adaptable to an increasingly diverse group of people. The expansion of the spectrum, the decline of the stigma, the availability of services have made autism an enormously popular diagnosis. And importantly, as a way for people who do not fit in to the whole, to explain themselves to others, and also to explain themselves to themselves. And this is more than just for the practical purpose of driving a particular service. Indeed, the category of autism now encompasses such a wide spectrum of individuals that the term has little meaning if not followed by a description of the person to whom it that it aims to denote. For individuals with conditions of known etiology, such as certain genetic disorders associated with intellectual disability, seizure disorders, or tuberous sclerosis, autism is often preferred as a primary rather than a secondary descriptor. For example, there would be a preference for autism instead of, say, tuberous sclerosis with autistic features. And this preference suggests that the symbolic value of autism for structuring experience and personhood comes precisely from its ambiguity. And I don't know. I mean, I suppose that this concept of autism could get so large that it goes away and is replaced by other things. Who knows what we'll think about in 20 years, 30 years. It'd be like the joke my mother always tells about popular restaurants she doesn't want to go to. She says, no one goes there anymore. It's too crowded. I love that paradox, by the way. So conditions of unknown cause and their associated ambiguity facilitate diverse and sometimes highly individualized interpretations that help people with autism and their families to cope with, understand, and appreciate their differences. Highly individualized interpretations. The trite phrase, if you've seen one person with autism, you've seen one person with autism, is no less apt for a person with asthma or headaches, dyslexia, any other condition, but there's something different about autism. Paradoxically, a person might accept, embrace, find useful a diagnosis of autism, but then resist it as constituting himself as a person. So the Autism Society of America's most recent campaign, for example, tells us, be unique, be you. And their other slogan, celebrate the uniqueness in us all. So this is just a question. I don't have a clear-cut answer to this, but why must autism's meaning be modified by an appeal to uniqueness? One answer, possibly, is that autism is not only ambiguous, but presents an inherent contradiction. The more broadly it is employed, the more it lacks in individual and social specificity. Is autism a disease or a disability? Or to say that in a more nuanced way, is it becoming less of a disease and more of a disability? How does autism as a category help or hinder autonomy and dignity? How and why can we include within autism an enormous range of individuals with different abilities and disabilities, from someone who's completely nonverbal and self-injurious to someone who has some autistic traits that help him to succeed professionally? For better or for worse, the puzzle piece is bound to autism and all the sites of its reification. Individualized education plans, in texts, in images, in walkathons, in merchandise emblazoned with the puzzle piece, in buildings illuminated in blue light. Also in individuals like my daughter, who identify themselves sometimes quite proudly as autistic. This is not to suggest that the logo will endure, but eliminate the puzzle piece and a new symbol would replace it. It could be the face of a child, a butterfly emerging from a cocoon, a ribbon, a flower, a sagittal image of the brain. We'll never eliminate symbols for autism as long as we believe that it's a real thing rather than just a temporary construct we've made for a particular historical moment. A symbol is always bound to something objective, even if that objective thing is an objective illusion, like the idea that Asperger's disorder really did exist in the world as a real thing between 1994 and 2014, and then now it no longer exists. Such a symbolic perspective, it's not meant to devalue the passion that people bring to autism, but quite the opposite, to celebrate them, because in accepting and resisting, in both accepting and resisting particular images of autism, we acknowledge that even if the core features of autism can be reduced to nature, to biological mechanisms and materials, the meanings and experience of autism are of our own making. And that's a good thing. Just because we make our own truths doesn't mean they're flawed, imprecise, or deficient, though we might see them as flawed, imprecise, and deficient in the future. Because as societies change, the functions of any particular diagnosis will change. Writing about a very different aspect of human thought and behavior that Paul Ricoeur said is often accused of being flawed, imprecise, and deficient, memory. He said that memory is devalued because it's flawed, imprecise, and deficient. It's devalued because it is a divergence from a kind of perfection, that is, perfect knowledge of the past. For Ricoeur, memory is actually a way of moving forward in time and should be celebrated as a remarkable capacity. But this view is only possible if we separate, if we shatter the historian's illusion that there is a real, objective, unfiltered truth to be found. It's possible only if we shatter the illusion that historical memory is, like the 19th century concept of schizophrenia as degeneration, from a point of origin. Let me repeat that. It's possible only if we shatter the historian's illusion that there is such a real thing out there, truth to be found. Only if we shatter the illusion that, like the 19th century concept of schizophrenia, memory is a degeneration from a point of origin. And there is a lesson for autism researchers in this critique of history. The constellation of behaviors and cognitive characteristics that we call autism today existed long before we made it into an object of knowledge and narrative, before we interpreted it, named it, and started the ongoing process of interpretation and redefinition. If anything, this sort of critique shines a light on how much we're actually capable of. Because our capacity for culture means we have the power to change the history of autism. We can make new pasts with new narratives and new metaphors. Thank you very much.